Good afternoon and welcome to today's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. My name is Michael Boskin. Today's program has been underwritten by the Corrett Foundation and Tobey Philanthropies. It is my pleasure to introduce an old friend, David Brooks, New York Times op-ed columnist and best-selling author of The Road to Character. For more than 10 years, David's insightful and compelling political and cultural commentary has appeared in the New York Times, reaching over 800,000 readers around the world. His extensive career in journalism started at Chicago's City News Bureau. He joined the Wall Street Journal as editor of the book review section and later served as their foreign correspondent and op-ed editor. David joined the Weekly Standard as their senior editor and also served as contributing editor at Newsweek and the Atlantic Monthly. He currently teaches at Yale University and is a regular commentator on PBS's The NewsHour and NBC's Meet the Press. Moderating this afternoon's program is Judge LaDoris Cordell. Judge Cordell spent nearly 20 years on the Santa Clara Superior Court bench and will soon be retiring from her post as the independent police auditor for the city of San Jose. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Brooks and, after he's finished, Judge LaDoris Cordell, who will come out and conduct and moderate the Q&A period. So please, let's hear a warm Silicon Valley welcome for David Brooks and Judge LaDoris Cordell.
Hello. Thank you. Judge may need to gavel soon. It's a pleasure to be back here in Palo Alto. I actually lived here for a little while. I didn't have a painful day in the whole time I lived here. I know people from the Valley well enough to know that I should be brief because you didn't come here to hear me speak. You came here to hear yourself speak. And so I'll try to get out of the way of that. I know some of you may be a little more progressive than I am, spun around this area. I want you to know I started out progressive when I was five. I lived in Greenwich Village in New York. My parents took me to a bee-in where hippies would go just to be. One of the things they did was they set garbage cans on fire and threw their wallets into it to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I was five, and I saw a $5 bill on fire in the garbage can, so I reached into the fire, grabbed the money, and ran away. And sort of that was my first step over to the Hoover Institution on the right. But it took a little while to take. I moved here, then I moved to Bethesda, Maryland, which is like Palo Alto. It's sort of a progressive, affluent suburb where everybody has Saabs, Audis, and Volvos. It's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy, that's fine. And people shop at progressive grocery stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, where all the cashiers are on loan from Amnesty International. My favorite section of there is they couldn't have pretzels and potato chips, that would be not moral enough, so they have these seaweed-based snacks. What we bought in my household is called Veggie Booty with Kale, which is for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colorectal cancer. And so that's a certain sort of progressive upbringing that I think I have and still have. But, you know, there are moments in that upbringing, and it's somewhat pretentious, somewhat pompous, somewhat normal. But there are moments in a life that break through the normalcy of life. And I remember I was doing the NewsHour. I do a show called the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer with a guy named Mark Shields. And I was coming home one Sunday afternoon after doing the show, and I pull into my driveway in Bethesda, Maryland, and the driveway looks into the backyard, and I see my three kids in the back, then 12, 9, and 5 or so. And I see them playing with a ball. They're kicking it up in the air, and it's curving and arcing in the wind. And I see their laughing and frolicking and running around. The weather's perfect. The sun is coming in. The grass is green. And it's one of those unexpected tableaus. I just looked at it through the windshield. And it's one of those moments when life and time seem to be suspended and reality spills outside its boundaries and you just get a sense of feeling overwhelmed with gratitude for a beauty you haven't earned. And when you get that kind of moment, it elicits a strange stirring. It opens up your heart and exposes tender ground. You get a sense of higher moral joy that's better than anything you ever get at work. And you sort of want to be worthy of it. And so I've had that experience sometimes in moments like that, sometimes being around people that I really admire. There are some people, I'm sure you've met them, who radiate an inner glow. I met some people in another part of Maryland about a year or two ago who teach immigrants how to read. And there's a room full of women, 30 or 40, and they just radiated a patience and a goodness and a modesty. And they make you feel important. They're not thinking about what great work they're doing with their service. They're not thinking about themselves at all. And so I had that thought that I've achieved way more in my career than I ever thought I would. But I haven't achieved that. I haven't achieved that inner light. There are certain some people who just radiate with it. And I thought in life one should try to get that. And so the way I think about it is, as I write in the book, there are two sets of virtues, the eulogy virtues and the resume virtues. The resume virtues are the things we bring to our job, and the eulogy virtues are the things they say about us after we're dead, whether you're courageous, honorable, brave, capable of great love. And we all know the eulogy virtues are more important, but we live in a culture that gives a lot more attention to the resume ones. A lot of us are more clear in how to get a good career than we are in how to build a deep inner life. And so I spent the years thinking about that. How do you do that? And I was assisted by a book written in 1965 called Lonely Man of Faith by Joseph Soloveitchik. And Soloveitchik argues that we have two opposing sides of our natures, which he called Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the resume side, the career-oriented side. Adam 1 wants to build, create, produce things, make some money. Adam 2 is the internal Adam. Adam 2 wants to embody certain moral qualities, wants to have a strong inner character that honors creation and one's own possibilities, wants to have a solid sense of right and wrong, wants not only to do good, but to be good inside. And so while Adam 1 wants to conquer the world, Adam 2 wants to obey a calling and serve the world. Adam 1 asks how things work. Adam 2 asks why things exist and what ultimately we're here for. And Soloveitchik's point is that these two Adams sometimes confront each other and sometimes live in tension. And I'd say the tension derives from the fact that they operate by different logics. The Adam 1, the external Adam, operates by economic logic. It's straightforward. Input leads to output, effort leads to reward, practice makes perfect. Adam 2, the internal Adam, lives by a moral logic, which is inverse and paradoxical. You have to give to receive. You have to surrender to something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success leads to the greatest failure, which is pride. Failure can lead to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. Now, we, as I say, live in a culture that nurtures Adam 1. It's a competitive world. You've got to spend a lot of time to try to make it, get a good job. It's a fast world of communications, which sometimes drown out the stall voices in the depth. We also live in a culture that tells us to celebrate ourselves. If you follow the commencement cliches, follow your passion, be true to yourself, trust yourself. We tell our kids how great they are, and they believe us. In 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school students, are you a very important person? And in 1950, 12% said, yes, I'm a very important person. They asked the same question in 2005, and it wasn't 12%, it was 80% who said they're a very important person. And so we've become a more self-assertive culture and a less humble culture. And humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. Humility is radical self-awareness from a position of other-centeredness. It's being able to see yourself accurately and know your strengths and your weaknesses, where you're strong and where you're broken. And if you live in that Adam 1 world and you don't have that radical self-awareness I found in my own life, you settle for a sort of moral mediocrity. You create yourself on a forgiving curve. You think, well, people seem to like me and I'm not obviously hurting anybody, so I must be doing okay. But gradually there's a gap between the sort of person you'd like to be and the sort of person you are. You don't deserve the sort of eulogy you would like, And you don't radiate that inner light that I saw in those ladies who were volunteers. And you're not worthy of the things that are given to you. So I spent the last 4 years really thinking about, how do you get there? And the book is a collection of people who were messy at age 20. They were not born good and virtuous, but by 70 they were really impressive. And I'll just mention three. The first is Dwight Eisenhower. When Eisenhower was 9, he wanted to go trick-or-treating and his mom wouldn't let him. And he punched the tree in his front yard and he punched it so bad that he rubbed all the skin off his fingers. His mom, this remarkable woman named Ida Eisenhower, sent him to his room and had him cry up there for an hour. She came up and bound his wounds and recited a verse, which was, "He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city." And when he wrote his memoirs 60-odd years later, Eisenhower said that was the most important conversation of his life because it taught him that he had a weakness, which was his temper. And he spent the rest of his life confronting that weakness. We think of him as this garrulous country club guy, but during World War II, during his presidency, he was filled with anger, blood pressure spiking, insomnia. He was a big hater, but he confronted that and knew he couldn't lead if he was consumed by anger. So he constructed a sweet disposition and an optimism and a confidence. He became strong in his weakest part. And what the Eisenhower example teaches us is that external climb is about beating other people at something, being competitive. But the internal climb is about confronting your own weakness. Thomas Merton once wrote that souls are like athletes. They need opponents worthy of them if they are to be tried and extended and pushed to the full extent of their power. And Eisenhower became great, like most of the people in the book, by confronting their weakness and combating it every day, by saying, what's my core sin? How does that sin lead to behavior I'm not proud of? For some, it's egotism, temper, emotional neediness. For him, it was the temper. The second figure I'll mention just briefly is a woman named Frances Perkins. Perkins was, it was 1913. She was somewhat scattered. She was trying to do good in the world, but didn't really know how. She's having tea outside in Washington Square in Lower Manhattan. And she hears a commotion. She rushes out into the square. She looks down and she sees a fire. She stumbles across one of the most famous fires in American history called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. And she sees what she thinks are bundles of clothing coming out of the windows. But it's not that. It's like 9/11. People are hurling themselves to their deaths as opposed to just burning to death. And so she sees 53 people go over the edge. She sees a guy hoisting the women over the windowsills and dropping them into space. A first, a second, a third, a fourth, his girlfriend who he kisses, and then he himself goes. And that moment solidifies her and gives her what you might call a call within a call. She had a vocation, she had a calling. But that moment hardened her, so from ever after, she would work with anybody, she would compromise with anything, she would do anything, and she organized around her life to become an instrument in the cause of worker safety. She went up to Albany, she was a lobbyist to the legislators. But the guys wouldn't take her seriously because she's a young woman, it's 1920s. She keeps a folder at home called Notes on the Male Mind. And she says, they won't take me seriously because I'm a woman, but all guys want to be loved by their mothers. So she dresses like an 80-year-old woman, gets her nickname Mama Perkins, and becomes an amazing lobbyist and passes some amazing legislation. And it's a story of someone who became an instrument in a cause. And if we look at the people who are deep, who are rich in her characters, we would say, like Eisenhower, they practiced self-defeat. They defeated their core weakness. We would also say they committed to things outside themselves. Character, I used to think character was an inner little Victorian figure of self-control, but none of us are strong enough to defeat our weakness on our own. We all need redemptive assistance from outside. And so a person with character has a fundamental commitment to philosophical truths, is enmeshed in a web of unconditional love, and is committed to a cause that can't be completed in a single lifetime. And through that fire, Perkins found that cause. And it solidified her, organized her, and gave her a great inner integrity. The final person I'll mention is George Eliot. Eliot was sort of emotionally needy. She fell in love with every guy she ever met, married, unmarried. She'd charm them. They'd become interested. Their wives would kick her out of the house. And so by 30, she was not that impressive. But at 32, she fell in love with a guy named Herbert Spencer, the philosopher, and she wrote him a note. And the note said, was somewhat pathetic. It was like, please marry me, please marry me, please marry me. You won't even notice me. I'll be around the house. I won't bother you. But then in the end, she ends with a flourish. And the flourish she wrote is this. I suppose no woman ever before wrote such a letter as this, but I am not ashamed, for I am conscious in the light of reason and true refinement that I am worthy of your respect and tenderness, whatever gross men or vulgar-minded women might say of me. It was an assertion of her own worthiness. And that's what you might call an agency moment, the moment usually in the 30s or 40s when you develop your own inner criteria and you don't need somebody's praise or criticism from outside. You know what's valuable and what's not valuable, what you're ashamed of and what you're proud of. It didn't work out with Spencer, but it worked out with a guy named George Lewes, another writer. Lewes was a writer. He was legally married, though his wife was living with another guy and had three children with the other guy. But still, he was legally married. And so Eliot falls in love with him and has to decide, if I go with Lewes, I will be labeled an adulteress and I will lose all my friends. I will lose my family. Do I pick Lewes or do I pick everybody else? She went with Lewes. She wrote, I have counted the cost of the step I have taken, and I'm prepared to bear without irritation or bitterness renunciation by all my friends. I am not mistaken in the person to whom I have attached myself. He is worthy of sacrifice I have incurred. My only anxiety is that I be rightly judged. And George Eliot is a person who is deepened by love. We would not say somebody had depth of character unless they were capable of great love, and she was capable of great love. First thing love does, it humbles you, it reminds you you're not in control of your own mind. The second thing is it opens up hard ground and makes you vulnerable. The third thing it does, it decenters the self, it reminds you your riches are not in yourself, they're in another. The fourth thing it does is it eliminates the distinction between giving and receiving because you and your lover are fused. And these are the idealistic romantic loves that Taylor Swift sings about. Eliot was older. She was already realistic about herself. She was realistic about her husband, her common-law husband. And she experienced what you might call a second love, the kind that comes later in life, that is more local and particular and realistic. A friend of mine named Leon Wieseltier wrote a wedding vow about this kind of love. This kind of love, he wrote, is private and it is particular. Its object is the specificity of this man and that woman. The distinctiveness of this spirit and that flesh. This love prefers deep to wide and here to there, the grasp to the reach. When the day is done and the lights are out, there is only this other heart, this other mind, this other face to assist in repelling one's demons or in greeting one's angels. When one consents to marry, one consents to be truly known, which is an ominous prospect. And so one bets on love to correct for the ordinariness of the impression and to call forth the forgiveness that will be required. Marriages are exposures. We may be heroes to our spouses, but we may not be idols. Eliot, somewhat messy as a young woman, is fortified and integrated by this power of love. And so I've just mentioned three people, the self-defeat, the sense of a vocation, the commitment to a great love. And the people in my book move from Adam 1 a balance between Adam 1 and Adam 2. And out of that balance comes great tranquility. Adam 1's ambitions are never satisfied. There's always something else out there. But the internal ambitions can be satisfied and can be achieved in moments of great self-respect. When you're not better than other people, you're better than you used to be. And you become aware of a certain constancy in oneself. Now, reading and certainly writing a book doesn't get you there. But these people are examples and roadmaps to us. And I found in writing the book that these people are like a posse of friends who live on in the mind, set an example with whom one can have a conversation and can inspire one on the road to character. So thanks very much.
Thank you. And I look forward to this part of our program, David. In your introduction to the book, you wrote about, and I quote, how some people have cultivated strong character, and that you wrote this book, quote, to save your soul. So was there a particular event, an aha moment in your life that was the catalyst for the book, or was this book something you had long planned to write, or is this book a product of midlife crisis, or combination thereof?
Yeah, I'll lie down on the couch and we can talk about my midlife crisis. You know, it really wasn't. You know, there's a phrase, the owl of Minerva flies at dusk, and that means wisdom comes after the fact. And looking back on my books, I've written a series of books all about the similar sort of person, but one level down. The first book was called Bobos in Paradise, which was about consumerism. And it was actually, some of my research was done here at the Restoration Hardware in Palo Alto.
That's right.
The second was about patriotism. The third was about psychology, called The Social Animal. And the fourth was about moral and spiritual life. And it's just a progression of trying to get deeper each time. And as I say, nothing horrible was happening in my life. I've had a blessed life, an amazingly blessed life. But it was inadequate. And the career success, it's a truism, but it's so true. Career success just wasn't fulfilling. I wanted something, wanted to be a better person. You know, we all have a responsibility to try to get better every day.
Well, you profile a dozen fascinating and strikingly different individuals in the book, from Francis Perkins, a fervent liberal activist in the early 1900s, to Bayard Rustin, and to St. Augustine, to football greats Johnny Unitas and Joe Namath. Given all of the fascinating people in the world, how and why did you settle on those 12?
First, I liked them all. Second, they were not born to greatness. They all, as I said, were messy at age 20. And so it was not natural to them. Third, they were all embodiments of different things that I think have to happen if you're going to develop character. For Dorothy Day, it was community. It was a total commitment to a community. Dorothy Day was the sort of person who couldn't just read books. She had to live them out. And unfortunately, she read a lot of Dostoevsky. And so as a young woman, she was drinking, carousing, suicide attempts, abortions. And she gave birth to a child, and for her, the birth of her child changed her. And she decided of all the childbirths she'd ever read about, all the experience of childbirth had always been written by men. And so she decided she was going to write one. And I think something like 40 minutes after giving birth, she sat down and wrote an essay. And it's an amazing essay. It appeared in the New Masses. And the
child ended up being a problem, though. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's
right?
True that she had
serious mental illness. And
yes. Yeah. But she had a beautiful sentence where she wrote, "If I had sculpted the greatest sculpture, painted the greatest painting, written the greatest symphony, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. And with that came the need to worship and to adore." And she became a Catholic, started a progressive newspaper, soup kitchens, and really became an amazing community builder. And so I picked people who had some experience like that, and they all had one thing in common. They all were aware of sin. And I think we've lost that awareness, but they were aware of their own sin, they were humble about it, and they struggled against it.
You also profile A. Philip Randolph. What was his sin?
He was a little less sinful. he was the one person in the book who's born. A. Philip Randolph was a great civil rights leader and chairman of the Pullman Porter Union in the early 20th century, before Martin Luther King, probably the most prominent civil rights leader in America. But he was an exemplification of dignity and reticence. And so he was someone who had a magnificent Shakespearean voice, but someone who it was impossible to humiliate and who was impossible to see, because he was so self-controlled and so dignified, it was impossible for him to commit scandal. And he was to me, a heroic leader, and then served as mentor to Bayard Rustin, a young man who was egotistical and a bit self-serving, and who had to discover the humility of serving in the background of the civil rights movement because of things that happened in his life.
Right. So after I read your book, it felt to me a bit like a confessional, at least in the beginning. So in the introduction you write, "I was born with a natural disposition toward shallowness.
I'm paid to be a narcissistic blowhard. I have lived a life of vague moral aspiration while lacking a clear understanding of how to live a rich inner life. So it feels as if you're preparing us for the bearing of your soul, but then you don't. So why not? Why didn't you tell us more?
First, I wanted to be honest, and I wanted to make it clear that I'm not a model for anybody. I'm not above anybody in this search. I'm a normal person, shallow person, looking for depth, not the great possessor of it. And so I wanted to make it clear I was on a journey. I was just asking people to come with me on the journey. And then as for why I didn't, first of all, I'm not that interesting. I'm certainly not that interesting to myself. And then finally, I do believe in privacy and reticence. So I do share a little. But I didn't want to go through the write a memoir about myself, because I think there are certain emotions that are so delicate and so inside that if you reduce them to simplicities of the sort of thing I do as a living as a pundit, you warp them. You eliminate some of the intricacies of an emotion by broadcasting it. And so I am a believer, like some of the people in the book, like George Marshall or Francis Perkins, in the sacredness of the private sphere. And I will reveal them to people with whom I have long experience and trust and love, but not so much, I don't want to make them, put them on public display.
I'm going to push this just a little bit more, though, because aren't all of these people that you've profiled seen and understood through the lens of David Brooks? And so that makes you and your journey extremely relevant to the book, doesn't it?
Well, but I'm, to be honest, I'm an average person with above average communication skills. And so I think to the extent that my books have sold and to the extent this one is will find an audience, it's because I'm not that different from other people. And when I tell the stories of the lives, it's not really me. I'm picking up parts of their stories, but many biographers have written about different of these people. And I'm just trying to write moral essays about them, taking out the pieces of their lives, and then trying to understand what we can learn from them. And so my essays are more moralistic. So I read about Samuel Johnson, somebody who suffered. And so in that essay, in that little chapter, I try to talk about how suffering can be used, how suffering sometimes is just suffering, but sometimes it can be used for good. And in Johnson's case, suffering became a tool for self-understanding. Paul Tillich, a theologian, said, when you're in a moment of suffering because you've lost a loved one or you've been dumped or you've lost a job, it takes you beneath the everyday aspects of life and reminds you you're not who you thought you were. That it takes you, it carves out a hole in the basement of what you thought was the floor of your soul, and then reveals a cavity below, carves out that floor and reveals a cavity below. And so for Johnson, when he suffered as a young man, he really understood himself. And so these stories are examples of about love, about suffering, about how to think of these things as occasions for moral growth and moral education.
Did you start with, say, like 50 people and then hone it down to the 12?
Yeah. And there were some I cut at the last moment, Moses. The hard part was finding a writer I admired. I wanted to get a literary person, and I finally got George Eliot, but I was looking through a lot of writers. They're not great people, so it's sort of worrying.
She was interesting. She was absolutely, is interesting. So I'm not a religious person. I don't go to church, even though I was raised in one that I attended religiously for the first 17 years of my life. But much of the road to character has a religious feel to it. For example, you make 70 references to sin, 6 references to grace, and numerous references to God. So this feels like a religious book with a focus on Christianity. Not that there's anything wrong with that. So is that the case? Is this a religious book?
I don't think it is a religious book. I think it's a secular book. But I do believe in religious terminology. And the first thing I should say, I believe there are wonderful people in the world who are complete atheists and wonderful people who are completely faithful. In the book, there are several atheists or at least agnostics. Dwight Eisenhower, George Marshall, George Eliot was an atheist. And some were religious. Dorothy Day and Augustine were obviously religious. But what I do think is important, people can make up their own minds whether they believe in God or not, but I do think words, the words that we inherit from Western civilization and from theology, from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are useful words. And it's very hard to think about moral life unless you use those words. So, for example, I didn't know how many times I used the word sin. That's a lot. But it's a big word for me. I think I like it for a number of reasons. First, when you use the word sin as opposed to weakness, it reminds you that life is a moral drama. Second, a weakness is something we have individually, but sin is something we have collectively. We all sin, and we all have the same sin, selfishness, self-centeredness, and it's something we combat communally. So it reminds us how we're all in it together. And then, I think unless you can see your own sin, you can't confront yourself. And I had trouble finding a good definition of sin. But the reason we got rid of it in our culture, because it was used to suggest we're depraved, it was used to crack down on sex, it was used by people who are smug and self-righteous. But to me, sin is just having your loves out of order. This is Augustine's definition. We all love a lot of things in life. We love success, we love fame, we like to be popular, we like truth, we like our family, we love friendship. But we all know that certain loves are higher than others. We all basically know that our love of truth is higher or should be higher than our love of money. But sometimes we get our sins out of order. And so, for example, a friend tells you a secret and you blab that secret at a dinner party to be interesting, you're putting your love of popularity above your love of friendship. And to me, that's sin, getting your love out of order. And we do that all the time. And I think it's useful to have that word. And if you don't have a word like sin or redemption or grace, the idea of being loved more than you deserve, you don't have a vocabulary to think about your own life.
Interesting. The road to character is filled with these delicious little gems, these little-known factoids that had me wanting more. So the exclamation point, for example, I never knew that it didn't appear on the typewriter until after World War II. Or the fact that the Girl Scout handbook changed from preaching an ethic of self-effacement to an ethic of self-aggrandizement. When you write about the cultural shifts in attitude and thinking in this nation, you have the feel, to me, of a social scientist. So is that what you are, a social scientist in columnist clothing?
I once called myself a comic sociologist, that I just go around making fun of people. But I do believe in social science. What I am is a translator. I read a lot of stuff that I don't have a job other than reading and writing. And so I don't have to go to meetings. All I can do is take stuff that I find in the culture and try to bring it to an audience. And so I spend a lot of time reading social science, reading academic books that have 80 readers, and trying to pick out the nuggets that seem interesting and explanatory to me and bring it to a lot more readers.
So let's change the pace a little. I'm going to call this a lightning round. David, I'm going to give you some names of some well-known people, and I want you to grade their character, sort of a character report card, if you will. So,
I'm like George Bush. I can peer into the souls of the people.
There you go. So an F is for someone who has an utter lack of character in your view, and an A is for someone who's full of it. So for example, an easy one. Adolf Hitler.
I got to go with F on that one.
There you
one.
Go. All right.
Okay. Is this going to get harder?
No, another easy one. So Jesus Christ.
You got to give an A.
Okay. All right. So you get the idea. So some of these aren't going to be so easy. All right. Here we go. All right. And you certainly can expound on your grade if you so choose. All right. First up, Michelle Obama.
Okay. I'm giving her an A. This administration, you can disagree with it, and I disagree with it on a lot of policy areas, but it's been unmarked by scandal, basically. And I do think the President and Mrs. Obama have set a pattern of integrity in the office that is just evident, whether you agree or not with the administration. So I'm going to give them high grades.
All right. Okay, next up, Dick Cheney.
I'm going to give him a C. And I think his family is fine. I do think there's a level of secretiveness in the way he conducted himself. And again, I'm not grading on political views here. Just in the way he conducts himself as a member of his administration, a secretiveness and a hostility to people who disagreed that have to be regarded as demerits.
Hillary Clinton.
I guess I have to go with B minus. It's funny. I don't have an honest answer about this because she's a bit opaque to me. I've met her many times, but I don't really have a feel for her. I talk to people who work closely with her, and they give wildly divergent views on what she's like. But I do think there's a secretiveness to her, certainly, and there's also too quick a tendency to be combative, I believe. When it would be possible to be open and to build trust, there's a tendency sometimes, I think, to lash out and to go on war footing.
Okay. Bill O'Reilly.
You got to give him an A for humility. I actually hesitate a little because media personas, it's hard to know what they're really like. And I've actually never read one of his books. I was actually on his show last week, but I don't watch it that much. But I would say as a public persona, one does have responsibility to broadcast a certain way of being in the world, a certain style of citizenship. And that's a style that recognizes that politics is a competition between half-truths and that each side has a piece of the truth, and usually issues are difficult for that reason. And I would not say he broadcasts that truth. So I'll give him a C or C minus, I guess. I'm grading the conservatives harder. Give me some
good things. All right, we got two more. Benjamin Netanyahu.
I'll give him a D plus. And that's, again, I'm on some issues I agree with him. On the Iran nuclear deal, I agree with him. But he is someone who runs through staff very quickly. He's someone Nixonian in his resentments. And so even if the members of his own party, the Likud party in Israel, don't have a great admiration for him, they feel they need him, they feel he's brilliant, he's amazingly brilliant. But I would say he is not someone who is widely respected for his character.
And your grade again was?
What did I say, D plus or
D
something?
Plus. Okay. Something. Last one, Edward Snowden.
So I'm going to give an F. I think when you take an oath and when you join an organization, you do not get to leak all the things within that organization to the press, and you don't get to violate your oath without a cost. We have a policy in this country about how we keep secrets and how we supervise, and you can agree with that policy or you can't. But it was set by a legitimate democratic process. It was set by a president, President Bush and President Obama, and it's not up to every 28 to decide he's going to destroy it. And so I think he behaved arrogantly in taking all of this responsibility on himself and destroying a process over which he had no right. And so there are many people I know who have suffered grievously because of what he did. And so I don't hold him in that high regard.
So before we start taking our audience questions, I've got one question before that. You first, as I read in your book, conceived this book as a treatise about cognition and decision making, and it became a book about morality and inner life. Now, those two subjects seem to be very different, cognition, thought-based, while the stuff of inner life is more faith-based. So why did you change the focus, and what was that a difficult transition to make?
Yeah, it was. My last book, The Social Animal, was about neuroscience and psychology. And a great book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow, came out on the shortcomings in our thought processes that are built into our nature. And so one of my favorite examples is that people applying to Israeli parole boards were granted parole. I think I'm going to get the number slightly wrong, but you get the idea. They were granted parole in like 20% of all cases by the parole boards, except for when the parole board met in the hour after breakfast and lunch, and then they granted parole in 60% of all cases. And so there are all sorts of things going on in our brains that we're not even aware of. If you apply to med school, you want your application to be read on a sunny day rather than a rainy day, because the admit rates are much, much higher. And so there are all these things going on in our brains. But then I think I came to realize that we also have bugs in our soul. You know, there's a guy named Dan Ariely, a Duke social scientist, who put out in the refrigerators at school, the common refrigerators, he put out dollar bills in the refrigerator and Coke cans. And within a week, all the Coke cans had been stolen. The dollar bills, not so much, even though they're the same value. People were happy to steal a Coke, but not happy to steal money. And so his lesson was that people are willing to be minorly dishonest all the time. But they don't want to think of themselves as bad people, so they won't steal the money. And so we have a tendency to be minorly dishonest all the time. And the stakes of that are high. And I came to feel that this moral issue was first core to all our lives, the central drama of our lives. And second, that we used to have a conversation in this country that was about moral issues. There were people like Abraham Joshua Heschel, Reinhold Niebuhr, Martin Buber, and there were all sorts of people talking about morality in public. Now I think the public square is very politicized, and we've got a lot of neuroscientists coming around, but we have very little public discussion of our moral nature. And so I thought there was a hole to fill, and it was a crying need in my own life. So I want to shift the conversation a little from politics and a little to spirituality, to morality, to character.
Such a social scientist, I have to tell you. So,
is that fighting words? Is that a compliment?
No, that's a good thing. It's okay. A good thing. So we're going to move now to questions from the audience. And I cautioned you before backstage, and I said, this Palo Alto audience, they are not going to be reluctant to ask questions. And indeed, while you were giving your introductory comments, I received this stack of questions, which is got at least an inch thick or more of questions. So we'll get through as many as we can. And so the first question is, I served on the Polaris submarines during the Cold War. Do you consider that an immoral act?
An immoral act.
Immoral act.
No, I think our side of the Cold War was defending democracy and freedom against an evil empire. I covered the end of the Soviet Union from Russia, it truly was an evil empire. The way people were treated there was horrendous. One of the great interviews of my life. If you remember, Boris Yeltsin was president of Russia, and the old guard staged a coup, and Yeltsin stood on a tank, if you remember, in front of the Russian Parliament building. And I happened to be there, and I ran to a 93-year-old woman handing out sandwiches, and I asked her, and she had known the Tsar. She had had a husband who was killed in the Stalin's purges. She'd had two sons who were killed in the World War II in the Battle of Leningrad. She'd had another husband who was sent to Siberia in the Gulag. She herself was part of a people, the Kalmyk people, that were moved around and displaced by Stalin. Her life was from the Tsar to Yeltsin. She'd experienced the whole history of the Soviet Union herself. And it was a life of real suffering caused by a totalitarian, very, very dark and very menacing regime.
Given that you are of Jewish heritage, I am surprised that not one Jewish person made it into your book. What about the great Jewish philosopher Moses Mendelssohn, for example?
No, he could be there. I have Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik throughout the book. He's one of the people I read a lot. And I did early on, until the very end of the process, I had a chapter on Moses, which had a lot of Jewish figures in it. And probably mistakenly, I cut that chapter out of the book because Moses isn't a historical figure the way the other figures are. But he was a different definition of leadership. The Greeks and the Romans had a definition of leadership, the big, bragging, honor and glory-seeking leader, you know, perfect body, you know, Charlton Heston type. And then Moses was the meekest man on earth. And when God asked him to become a leader, he says, no, I'm not worthy, I can't do this. And so he exemplifies a sort of servant leadership. And it's an indictment of our culture that we can't understand that kind of humble leadership that Moses embodied. And when Cecil B. DeMille made a movie about Moses, he cast Charlton Heston in the role as if he was some big, muscle-bound, perfect human being. But he wasn't, and it's a kind of leadership that should inspire us, a kind of servant leadership.
So, But the question was, why did you not include someone Jewish?
Yeah, I just didn't do it. I wasn't conscious of it as a quota system. And so maybe I should have been, but I don't know.
Next question. As I head to college next year, what is the best way to find a balance between resume and being a virtuous person? As a young person, it feels impossible to focus solely on the latter.
Well, I would say a couple things as you go to college. One, find a group of friends with whom to have conversations about non-academic matters. Two, take enough courses in literature and the humanities that introduce you to spiritual life, that introduce you to great philosophy, great theology, great biography, no matter what your parents say. I teach college. I've never had a kid come up to me and say, you know, I really want to major in finance, but my parents are forcing me to major in art history. That never happens. It's always the reverse. And, you know, I teach in the liberal arts. I'm a huge defender of the liberal arts. The final thing I'll say, and this I learned the hard way, an important decision everyone makes in life is who to marry. And so read books about marriage. George Eliot, Jane Austen, these are the masters. They'll teach you about your own heart, and that's a very useful thing to understand.
Has writing this book made you a happier person?
You should say that. I teach this course I teach the book as a class. I taught it three times. And one of my best students, who's now a Rhodes Scholar, at the end of the course, he said, you know, since taking this course, I'm a much sadder person. And I took that as a high compliment. Because if you're skating through on the surface of life, feeling so pleased with yourself, and you're like a student at Yale, you're getting a Rhodes Scholarship, maybe you need to be a little sad. Maybe there's something to be sad about, something to be introspective about. So I confess I probably am a little sadder, but hopefully on the way. But also, I'm more emotional, let's put it that way. I have higher highs and lower lows. And you might as well live life to the fullest and experience it as opposed to just living at the level of Twitter.
How do you manage to keep your sense of self-esteem and composure when people criticize you?
Yeah, I'm like the rest of us, I'm not that great at that. The first 6 months on the job at the New York Times was a very hard thing. I was a conservative columnist at the New York Times, a job I likened to being chief rabbi at Mecca. And so in those days, they put our email addresses right in the column, right at the bottom of the column. And so I was getting tons of emails. And after 6 months on the job, I was cleaning up thousands, hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of emails. And the core message of my readers was, Paul Krugman is great, you suck. And so it took me a long time to get a skin thick enough to be able to live with that. I'd never been hated on a mass scale before. And they were really good haters. They would pick about exactly the things I was insecure about. But you just never get used to that. You just don't.
In a recent blog post, John Warner says that you have it all wrong. He summarizes his viewpoint as, people aren't failing the world around them. The world around them is failing people. How do you respond?
Well, I mean, I agree we have certainly problems with society. But I do think, I guess our founders would be on my side of this argument. Of course, we need politics. We need structural reforms in our society. I would never deny that. But Adams, Monroe, Hamilton, they're all believers in the idea that the virtue of the citizenry is essential to the conduct of democracy. And so we talked about Bill O'Reilly earlier. I think part of the rise in narcissism has been a rise in polarization. Because if you think you have a truth by the short hairs and the people who disagree with you are just in the way, but if you have a modest sense of your own awareness of the truth, then you need the people who disagree with you. And to conduct a proper democracy, you have to have people who are willing to have conversations. And that's a matter of virtue, that's a matter of intellectual virtue. And so, of course, we should do structural reform, and of course, society has to be fixed. But internal improvement and moral progress feeds into social progress as well.
What book, besides yours, would you recommend to a high school student to learn about character and virtues?
That's a good question. It's hard to pick just one. I will say, well, this is more of a religious book. A lot of things are running through my brain. One of them is a book that was my favorite book in high school was a book called All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, which is about politics and about approaching life in politics. I'm a big Russian novel guy, so Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Those books are very hard to read without feeling one's in the presence of a large soul, both Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, the capacity to understand other people, to experience just the range of emotions. One of my favorite scenes in all literature takes place in Anna Karenina. A young woman named Kitty is going to the ball, and Tolstoy describes what it was like to put on a dress and have everything feel perfectly. And I don't know how he did this as a man. Maybe his wife helped him. But she puts on the dress. It fits perfectly. The shoes fit perfectly. She has velvet around her neck. It fits perfectly. She's the belle of the ball. She's being danced by everybody. She's waiting for the final dance when the man she thinks is going to propose to her will ask her to dance and propose. And you get this sense of uplift and magic that she's going through and feeling at the ball. And for some reason, the guy hasn't yet asked her to that final dance. And she's whirling around the dance floor. She sees a man named Vronsky, and he has a look of love in his eyes. And she swirls back, and she sees he has the look of love, but he's not looking at her. He's looking at someone else, Anna Karenina. And she immolates inside. Her whole insides collapse. And to read a scene like that is an emotional education. It widens the repertoires of emotion that you're capable of. And it doesn't give you new knowledge, but it gives you a new experience. And so that's the kind of book you want, just to widen your repertoire of emotions. So as you go through life, you have this repertoire to confront life with.
Can you comment on religious freedom and the gay marriage collision? And paint for us a platform of coexistence and mutual respect without violating one's own conscience.
I think there is a tension. I'm a big supporter of gay marriage. I wrote a column, I think in about 2003, saying gay people shouldn't only be allowed to marry, they should be coerced into marrying. that if you have your friends are gay, you should say, are you getting married? Are you married yet? Shouldn't you get married? And so that's long been my position. But I know many people who are Orthodox Christians, Orthodox Jews, and Muslims, who they have nothing against gay people, but they have religious prescriptions about gay marriage. And I don't agree with them, but I see them as good people, struggling the best they can with this issue, trying to find the right thing. And I just think there's so much progress has been made. I think it would be a mistake to turn into a big culture war issue. I think it's a mistake to try to coerce people into doing things that violate their religious beliefs. If they're a bakery owner and they'd rather not work a gay marriage, I'd say go find another baker. And don't coerce them. There's this couple that they've lost their business and they have to pay a $125,000 fine because they didn't want to work a gay wedding. And so I think just on a practical...
Let me just interrupt one second and ask you, do you feel the same way? What if it were they just said, we don't want to make cakes for black people?
Or Jews. I feel the same way.
So how is that different? Yeah.
Now, that's something I struggle with a lot. I do obviously think people should be fine if they don't work a African-American wedding or a biracial wedding or anything like that. I would say the difference is, I've asked many people, Christians, this question. And I'm not sure I totally agree with their answer, but they say one's a matter of essence and one's a matter of behavior. But I'm not sure I totally buy that, to be fair. I wrote a column on this, and as a matter of sheer pragmatics, so much progress has been made on the path toward equality. that I think it's useful not to start a culture war about that, but to let the progress continue. And that is being done by keeping the momentum. I think if we create this dynamic in which gay rights somehow seem opposed to religion, then people in parts of America which are highly religious, say in Indiana where this thing is a flashpoint in a rural town in Indiana, I think it'll end up hurting the kid who wants to come out, because there'll be this dynamic where the religious communities will get their backs up and then there will be just conflict, where I think we're moving toward greater acceptance. You look at all the poll numbers, all the progress that's being made today in the Supreme Court, and I just as a matter of pragmatics, I'd rather keep it going.
I'm going to try to combine these two questions. All right. What are your thoughts on cultivating more character in politics, and on a character scale of 1 to 10, who among the slate of characters for our next president rank near the top, and why?
Well, I do think character is important in politics. Politics, like a lot of businesses, is about relationship building. And to build relationships requires honesty, sympathy, empathy, consideration, trust. And if you can't do those things, you're not going to be a successful politician. And if you are fundamentally broken inside, your Watergate will come. You'll be twisted by your own resentments. And so I do think a base of basic decency and goodness is required to be a successful leader. I also think that politicians face awesome character challenges. They're in a business where they are the product. Every meeting they go to is about me, me, me. They're surrounded by people who are sycophants, who are just sucking up to them and who are flattering them. And to keep what I notice a lot of them lose is the internal voice of honesty. They begin to believe their own propaganda. They have what I call Lagerie dementia. They talk so much that they drive themselves insane. And they hollow themselves out. They don't have an internal voice. And when you lose that internal honesty, that internal self-awareness, you really have lost the conscience. And you become sort of a hollow figure. And I find that all the time in politics, because they spend so much time in busy travel from one place to another. The final thing I'll say is that I spend a lot of time around politicians, over meals and in interviews, and most of them went into it for the right reason. Their life is not that glamorous. They wouldn't have done it for simple ego. They really want to do good, but they're just stuck in a rotten system.
Whatever happened to shame?
Shame requires, of course, shame is one of these things. Aristotle is wise here, that we want to have, it wants to be practiced in moderation. We don't want somebody who is completely self-hating all the time, and we do know people like that. On the other hand, we don't want people who are unembarrassable and who can commit the most amazing acts with no embarrassment and no shame whatsoever. I'm struck by the sense that we all are born with moral imagination. We all want to lead good lives. We spend a lot of time talking about happiness in the society. And, we've learned things about happiness. We've learned that money doesn't really correlate to happiness. If once you make above, say, $80,000, $125,000 a year, the amount of extra happiness you get from making more money is pretty minimal. We've learned there's an age pattern to happiness. People are happy in their 20s. Then happiness dips down until it bottoms out at about age 47, which is called having teenage children. And then it shoots up. And the 10 happiest years are the years after retirement, the first 10 years after retirement. And so happiness is important, and I'm all for having good experiences and joyous. But I've never met anybody where you said to them, well, what was the experience that really made you who you are? And they said, I went on to Hawaii on vacation. I had an awesome time. That made me who I am. No one ever says that. They usually point to a time of challenge in their life. And they say, that's what made me who I am. So we plan for happiness, but we're formed by hardship. And most of us are born with a moral imagination. We want to lead good lives, not just happy lives, but lives with some meaning. And I find that in my students. I find that in people of any age. And so I do think that sense of shame is almost built into us. We're moral creatures.
What is the best innovative way to support or teach character in K through 12 schools?
Well, the most important thing is the quality of the teachers. And so, I don't know about you, but I barely remember the teachers I had. I mean, what they taught me, but I remember who they were. And I was writing a column about how hard it is to teach morality in a classroom. And I got an email from a guy named Dave Jolly, who's a veterinarian up in Oregon. And he said, never forget that what a wise person says is the least of what he gives. What gets communicated is the totality of the person, their small gestures of kindness and caring and honesty that were handed to that person by a mentor and by that person to a mentor on into the dim mists of time. And then he said, never forget, the message is the person. And those two sentences, what a wise person says is the least of that which he gives, and the message is the person, that really resonated with me. We all have had people in our lives who just communicated by the way they were in the world, their kindness, their regularity, their constancy, their ability to show up, that how one should behave. And just two quick examples. One, I'm not Catholic. I don't know much about Catholic theology, but I like the way Pope Francis conducts himself. And the message is the person. And I used to do a show with a guy named Jim Lehrer, and on screen, Lehrer had a very stoic expression. But off screen, when I was talking, his face was quite expressive. And when I would say something that was egotistical or embarrassing, I could see the little mouth curl downward. And when I say something he liked, I could see a little crinkle of happiness in his eyes. And so for the 10 years I did the show, I tried to avoid the mouth crinkling down, and I tried to get the eyes. And that's sort of how mentorship works. He didn't ever say anything to me, but I just saw his reactions, and I wanted to earn his respect. And so that was an education for me.
Do you and Paul Krugman ever sit down and hash it out?
Yeah. You know, that we travel so much, and we work in different offices, so we don't see each other all that much. I've seen him a handful of times in the 10 or 13 years I've been doing this, but we never have. Probably a good thing he's a Nobel laureate. My Nobel Prize lost in the mail so far.
Well, unfortunately, we have reached that point in the program. We have time for just one last question. In visiting Monticello, you commented that you were impressed that Thomas Jefferson had covered the walls with portraits of people who served as inspirations for him. So whose portraits cover your walls?
Well, I have, the people I admire most, Elliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner, no, I'm kidding. So the people in the book are on my walls. The Bayard Rustins of the world, the Dorothy Days, Augustine. But my two big heroes, they're more intellectual heroes than personal heroes. I have personal heroes too, but one is Alexander Hamilton. He was a boy, he lost his mom, who died in the bed next to him when he was 12. His dad had split. He was adopted by his grandfather, who died within a year. And by 14, he had lost everybody. And by 25, he was George Washington's chief of staff and a war hero. By 35, he'd written the Federalist Papers, was a lawyer. By 45, he'd retired as Secretary of Treasury. And he created a system of government that believes in using government to enhance social mobility, to give poor boys and girls like him a chance to succeed. And so that, as you know, someone raised by my grandfather, had very much an immigrant mentality and a great desire to make it in America. And so Hamilton is the embodiment of that for me. And then the second person is Edmund Burke, a philosopher whose work is organized around the phrase epistemological modesty, that we should be modest about what we know, and we should respect the gifts that were handed down to us by our ancestors. And those are really my two. If you take those two thinkers and you put them together, I haven't had any original thoughts. I've just borrowed from them. And so they're two heroes of mine.
Thank you. Thank you so much for spending this time. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and underwritten by the Corrett Foundation and Tobey Philanthropies. Again, we would like to thank David Brooks, the always interesting, informative, insightful, and humorous New York Times op-ed columnist and best-selling author of The Road to Character. Our great moderator, Lidoris Cordell, Judge Lidoris Cordell. Our audience here in Palo Alto, let's give them a hand. And those of you joining us on the radio and the web, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating 112 years of enlightened discussion, is hereby adjourned.